this.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis Media. Jim Morrison died at the age of 27, and he lived a life that was anything but predictable. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 15 would be the number of seconds that Jim left his body on stage, that he transcended himself, or so was the story that his bandmates would tell later on. Another one would be the number of his most valued collaborators who bailed as the Doors faced their most prolonged crisis, leaving Jim and the boys to figure it out on their own. Three more would be the number of American serial killers that would bang around his subconscious and inspire the final song on his final album. Another one would be the number of girlfriends who would summon him to Paris and encourage him to purchase a one-way ticket to the fabled City of Lights. And seven would be the number of months he had left to live when the original four members of the Doors took the stage for the last time in New Orleans for a show that was part rock fest, part train wreck, and part seance. On this, our 10th episode of Season 2, Prolonged Crisis, Serial Killers, A Rock and Roll Seance, and Jim Morrison Lost in Fantasy. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. There were strong forces at play in New Orleans on Saturday, December 12, 1970, when the Doors took the stage for the last time with their lead singer, Jim Morrison. Some of the forces were prosaic, but undeniable. The wilting chemistry between a trio of musicians and their malcontent frontman was ripe. The audience could sense it, they could see it, feel it. Jim didn't want to be there. In his mind, he was already elsewhere. The fantasy differed from day to day, but it was always evolving. Anywhere was better than where he was at. Jim's disgruntled stance frustrated the others in the band, because musically they were kicking ass again. Morrison Hotel had been a welcome return to form, and now the new songs they were debuting, songs like L.A. Woman and Riders on the Storm, were even better, rough, rollicking, tapping into late-night recesses of the American psyche unlike they had before. If only they could get Jim to give a shit. Jim was still reeling from a year of chaos. The office party meltdown, the Miami trial, Patricia's abortion, wild coke-fueled nights of bloodletting and sex. He no longer found solace as the Doors' frontman. He had just turned 27 earlier that month. There were other forces, too. They were harder to describe, harder to see. Supernatural forces, deep dark forces that were a natural consequence of tapping into that late-night voodoo. In her preview of the concert for the State's Item, Molly Chancey described the Doors' music as demonic. She called it savage and a nightmarish glimpse into the other side. And Jim gave her some juicy quotes that backed her up. "It's a recognition of forces that rarely see the light of day," he told her. New Orleans played host to the gathering of forces, a city of ritual, mystery, and magic. New Orleans reveled in this kind of scene-making. The seen and unseen were palpable in New Orleans. This final show with Jim at the mic was at a venue called The Warehouse. It was the popular venue in the Big Easy for rock shows, and had just opened for the first time earlier in the year with a show by Fleetwood Mac and the Grateful Dead. The infamous show where the Dead and their entourage were busted by local fuzz for drugs. A bust they'd immortalize in song. Lemons turned into some strange lemonade trip. Busted, down on Bourbon Street, set up like a bowling pin. For Ray, John, and Robbie, it was another show with their mood-swinging rock star frontman, so they were prepared for anything. They were excited to test out some of their new material live, songs that they felt were pushing them in exciting new directions. Jim, on the other hand, saw faces in the crowd from the stage. Faces randomly sprinkled within the mass of Louisiana good-timers. He saw Jimi Hendrix second row back, his arms folded across his chest, judging him. He saw Janis Joplin, half-empty bottle of Southern Comfort in her hand, waiting in the wings. As always, she was ready to pounce on Jim as soon as he made the wrong move. She'd pounce and waste no time, bringing that bottle down on his head, even if it meant losing the rest of the liquor inside. But Jimmy and Janice were both dead. He must be seeing things. That New Orleans voodoo was working a little too well. It was all too real. Was he inside his fantasy now? Was he on the other side? The side where Jimmy and Janice and Otis and Brian all spent their eternal days? Or was that side breaking through to him? Jim decided to pull the ripcord. Fuck it. He needed to back away from the faces of the crowd. Back away from the forces. It was late in the set. He had missed lyrics left and right all night, missed cues, sometimes because he genuinely forgot them, and other times because he just couldn't work up the interest to go through the motions. He tried to tell a joke, but no one in the crowd was quite ready for Jim Morrison, the stand-up comic. The band had started noodling during the middle section of Light My Fire when Jim decided to sit on the drum riser. It was hard to tell which of the forces was steering the ship. He was spent, tired of being Jim Morrison. Along came Mr. Goodtrip, looking for a new ship. Jim sat with his head hanging down as the group spun through the song's labyrinthian middle section, casting webs of organ and guitar over the rock-solid drum pattern. He pressed his eyes into the palms of his hands. If he pressed hard enough, maybe he could make those spectral visions go away. The dead here among the living, the dark coming forth into the light. Ray hunched over his Vox Continental and Fender Rhodes piano bass, peered over at Jim from above the top rim of his glasses. He watched as the air above Jim's body vibrated like heat rising, and at first he thought it had something to do with John's drum kit. He squinted his eyes and looked harder and watched as a translucent mass the size of Jim's body floated above where Jim was sitting. It hovered in the air, and for a brief moment, Ray thought that the Eastern motif he was playing with his fingers on the Vox Continental somehow had something to do with it, like he was extracting something from Jim's body. Jim sat motionless while the band wore on. The translucent figure was gone now, just about as quickly as it had appeared. But Ray was convinced Jim had left the stage. The body that sat there on John's drum riser was just that, a body, a shell, a vessel. Jim had most certainly left the building. John, on the other hand, wasn't witnessing any out-of-body phenomena. He looked down and saw his lead singer being a prima donna pain in the balls again. John had just about enough of Jim's sulking. And so, as they approached the return to the song's verse, John stuck his leg out and kicked Jim's back with his foot. Jim sprung back to life, feet back on the stage, mic stand back in his hands. He picked up the mic stand, a long piece of shimmering silver that ran down to a circular base on the stage floor, and raised it up to his chest, and then he brought it down. Whack! The base of the mic stand dug into the hard wood of the stage floor, and the audience first thought it was a particularly loud drum hit, until they saw Jim raise the mic stand in the air again. Whack! He brought it back down, so hard, this time, that the hardwood started to splinter. Then, three more times in quick succession, and little pieces of the wood flew back into the air for the force. The mic started to feed back, and then fell off the stand and hit the floor with a thud. Jim kept slamming the stand into the stage until he felt like he had slammed it enough, until it had broke on through, until he had made his point. He walked off. He was done. Paul Rothschild bailed first. Before New Orleans, before Jim left a shattered stage floor in his wake, Paul Rothschild threw in the towel. He had had enough. He had sat in the producer's chair for every Doors album since the beginning. He had watched Jim go from a fully committed participant to a barely there fly on the wall. Paul was a veteran, nearly 100 albums produced. He had just finished recording Janis Joplin's album, Pearl, a labor of love by all involved. The experience was life-affirming for Paul. Janis was committed. The band was committed. Everything about it was the way a record production should be. And now, Paul had to transition from cloud nine with Janis to a dark cloud with Jim. And it was a trip he didn't feel like he could take. The making of Pearl was compounded by the sudden and unexpected death of Janis Joplin from an apparent heroin overdose in her hotel room in Hollywood. Paul began to worry when she was a no-show for a vocal session. Her tour manager drove to the Landmark Motor Hotel and found her on the floor of her room next to her bed. She was only 27. It had only been 16 days since Jimi Hendrix died in London, and Paul was in shock. He had bonded with Janis, believed in her music. Janis had her own demons, though, and fought them off with her own regimen of self-medication, just like Jim Morrison. Paul drew the parallels between the two singers, and after watching Janis walk down the path to self-destruction, he identified Jim on the same path, headed to the same tragic fate. The Doors were far from ideal, far from perfect, but Paul had spent most of his quote-unquote production duties as of late corralling Jim, wrangling him. At recording sessions, Jim was either disinterested or drunk, sometimes both. His ongoing desire to destroy everything was exhausting and indicative of a desire to destroy himself. Paul didn't need a psychologist to see that. The weight Jim had gained, the beard he had grown, it was like he was hiding in plain sight, disappearing, becoming more and more like the spitting image of that lughead Jimbo that he hung around with. Jim's voice had dropped to a low, guttural growl. It wouldn't be much longer before he wouldn't be able to sing at all. Shortly after Janis had died, Paul and Jim were drinking at a bar in Hollywood. Jim was unusually affable, though it was probably that early drunk high he got after a few drinks, before the 10th or 11th drink sunk him into total darkness. He finished a pint and slammed the empty glass mug down on the sticky bar. He slapped Paul a few times on his back. "That's right," he said to Paul. "Brian, Jimmy, Janis, you're drinking with number four, Paulie." And then there was the problem with Jimbo. Jim was spending more and more time with him, and Jimbo's influence was increasingly dark and nihilistic. Paul couldn't do it, couldn't put on the brave face and power through it. He wasn't going to be part of Jim Morrison's inevitable undoing. And even if he could muster the strength to carry on, the Doors simply weren't the band he had fallen in love with at the beginning. Those first three albums were great, they were unique, there was something special there. But the Soft Parade was a dumpster fire, and then the incident in Miami took that flaming dumpster and dropped it into a full-on circus. The band were rehearsing new material for their sixth LP in the basement of their offices on Santa Monica Boulevard, the Doors Workshop, they called it. And Paul tried to sort through the material they had provided. L.A. Woman and Riders on the Storm were strong songs, but the band was off, way off, and Paul wasn't able to correct their course. Paul took them to the studio, back to Sunset Sound, the studio where they made their first record. Perhaps being in a professional environment would lend some professionalism to the whole thing. Perhaps they could recapture some of that original magic. Paul sat at the control panel, his trusty jar labeled KD next to him, Killer Destroyer, his killer stash of killer grass. The band wasn't coming together. They were expecting Paul to do all the heavy lifting for them, sort through the lumpy coal to find a well-hidden diamond. They tried another new tune, Love Her Madly, and it sounded like cocktail jazz to Paul. Wanna be her daddy? Fuck this shit, Paul thought. The band was bored, stilted. Paul had taken them as far as he could. Even the promise of a $250,000 payday wasn't enough to keep Paul in the producer's seat. The Doors were shocked when Paul said he was leaving. Before he walked out for good, he told them that the only way they could get back on track was to make the record themselves. They had to be invested. They had to be in the driver's seat. No more passive participation. Either they were all in it together or they were done. And then he left and took his Killer Destroyer with him. Paul Rothchild's departure served as one last wake-up call. The Doors weren't quite done yet. They'd hit the wall soon enough in New Orleans, but now they were going to listen to what their longtime producer, confidant, and honorary Fifth Door was telling them. Do it yourselves. It happened fast. First, they made sure that Bruce Botnick, their longtime engineer, would co-produce the album with them. He agreed. Next, they decamped back to the Doors' workshop. They were gonna strip it all back, make this thing in the trenches, guerrilla style. No fancy studio, no hangers-on, no distractions. They were gonna focus, do it live, do it themselves. The Doors' workshop was a grown-up tree fort, empty bottles and magazines scattered everywhere, large yellow glass ashtrays full of snubbed-out smokes, a jukebox in one corner, a pinball machine in another. And they sat up their instruments in the basement rehearsal room, hung movers' quilts to the walls to absorb the sound, hung towels over the windows to keep the outside at bay and direct focus on each other. There would be no day, there would be no night, there was nothing beyond that basement room. Jim ripped out the door to the bathroom so that he could record his vocals in the stall, taking advantage of the sweet reverberating sound of the tiles. But with the door gone, he could maintain visual contact with his bandmates. They brought in Jerry Sheff, fresh off a Las Vegas run with the King himself, Elvis Presley, to play bass. They hired Leon Russell's guitar player, Mark Benno, to play rhythm guitar so that Robbie could focus on leads while they captured everything as live as they could. Jim was actually on time. Jim was actually focused. Jim was actually inspired by this new role, leader of a blues band in a blacked-out basement room, like a bunch of high school kids making racket for the first time as their parents rolled their eyes upstairs. Bruce dragged the console over from the studio and set it up in Bill Sidden's office on the first floor. The setup was lean, the console, some speakers, the tape machine, and an intercom microphone so he could communicate with the band in the basement. For one of the biggest bands in the world, one with unlimited resources despite their scandals and troubles, this was a seriously DIY move. As back to basics as a band could get, they heeded the call of their exhausted producer, pulled their shit together, did it themselves. And it happened fast. The majority of the sessions for the album that would become LA Woman were tracked in under a week. The music cooked. The title track barreled through at 7+ minutes like Jim's Blue Lady tearing down the 101. The Changeling and Been Down So Long were thick hunks of window-covered basement blues. They got weird with L'America and got pretty with Hyacinth House. In hindsight, it's probably a good thing that it all happened so fast. Any longer and the tears in the fabric of the band that had been mended in their time of crisis would have split open again. It didn't take much. Soon enough, they would see that all it took was a shitty show in New Orleans to bring them all crashing back down to face the reality that they just weren't in it for the long haul. The Doors weren't going to make it. They all decided to take a break after New Orleans. They canceled their upcoming shows at Madison Square Garden in January of 1971. Jim started talking about leaving the country. Pam had spent more time in Paris recently, and she wanted him to follow her there. He'd have to face the music soon and do his time for the Miami incident. With things heating up at home again, his attorney, Max Fink, told him that there was a possibility that his passport could be taken. If there was ever a time to split, now might be it. But before he could go anywhere, Bruce needed him back in the studio one last time. He had to put final touches on Riders on the Storm, one of the eeriest songs in the band's catalog. That drew equally from gory true crime sprees, old western songs, and Jim's non-existent film career. Jim met Bruce in LA, put on a pair of headphones, and put his lips to a microphone one last time. And he went out with a whisper.
We'll be right back after this word.
Billy Cook shot the dog last. He had dumped the Mosser family down a mineshaft outside of Joplin, Missouri. First the parents, Carl and Thelma, and then the children. Ronald, 7 years old. Gary was 5. Little Pamela Sue was only 3. Just moments earlier, Cook raised his .32 caliber snub-nosed pistol and pulled the trigger 5 times, and they were all dead. Thelma had begged for her life. The tears ran down her face as she begged Cook to at least spare the lives of her children. Cook didn't care in the least. He acted quick and without emotion. He told his daddy when he had been released from prison earlier that year that he was gonna, quote, live by the gun and roam. And God damn it, that's what he was gonna do. People would die. He dragged the bodies from the 1949 blue Chevy sedan across grass and gravel and threw them down the mine shaft. The dog whimpered as it followed Cook to the mouth of the mine shaft while he dragged the last body over. Cook turned around slowly and pulled the trigger a final time. The shot rang out, empty and lonely, across some unremarkable Missouri grassland. Cook threw the dog down on top of the others, got back in the driver's seat, and hit the highway.
There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad.
It was December 1950. Carl Mosser had been driving his family through Oklahoma en route to New Mexico when they saw the hitchhiker on the side of the road, riding Thumb. Mr. Mosser's sedan was almost at max capacity. The wife, the kids, the dog. But they had room, and Mr. Mosser was a neighborly guy, so he pulled over. "Where you headed?" Mr. Mosser hollered out the window that Thelma had just rolled down. "Headed west, mister," was the hitchhiker's response. The collar of his denim jacket was pulled up to shield his neck from the wind. Of course, the hitchhiker wasn't headed west. The hitchhiker, Billy Cook, was headed south, south of heaven. Billy Cook had other plans. Billy Cook was going to kill this family. The first thing Mr. Mosser noticed about Cook was his deformed eye. It sagged down like someone had grabbed hold of his face on both cheeks and pulled down on one side. As soon as Cook climbed in the car, Mr. Mosser had a bad feeling. The next thing Mr. Mosser noticed were the tattooed letters on Cook's left hand, the letters H-A-R-D imprinted above the knuckles on each finger, L-U-C-K imprinted below the knuckles. Hard luck? The Mosser family was about to get a free lesson in hard luck. Mr. Mosser saw the tattoos when Cook drew his small .32 and pointed it to the back of his wife, Thelma's head, and told Mosser to turn the car around.
The killer awoke at dawn. He put his boots on.
The children, squashed like sardines in a can next to Cook in the back seat, tried to move their bodies as far away from the hitchhiker as they could. The boys clung to their hop-along Cassidy cowboy hats. Pamela Sue wrapped herself up in her baby blanket and cried. For 72 hours, Cook made the family drive a serpentine route back to Joplin, his hometown. They wound through Texas, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and they reached Joplin after sundown on New Year's Day, 1951. And almost as soon as they had crossed the city line, a police car passed them. Thelma rolled down her window and screamed for help, and Mr. Mosser slammed on the brakes. The children's cries echoed their mother's. Thelma flailed her arms, and Cook told them all to shut the fuck up. Mr. Mosser rolled his window down and stuck his arms out into the cold night air. Cook reminded them he would start shooting if they didn't stop screaming and flailing about. The police car didn't stop, and the Mossers didn't shut up. So Billy Cook shot them all.
"If you give this man a ride, sweet family will die."
Billy Cook was never given a chance as a child. His mother died when he was 5. Legend has it that Cook discovered her body after she had suffered a freak accident with a hatchet in her face. His father, an abusive boozer, drove Cook and his 7 siblings out to an abandoned mine and left them for dead. When authorities found the children, Cook was the only one who wasn't placed in foster care. His temper and violent outbursts got him a one-way ticket to reform school, and eventually to the Missouri State Prison as a teenager. They called him Billy Cockeyed Cook due to his right eyelid, which sagged low and wouldn't close. When he slept, the eyelid stayed open. When he was released at the age of 21, he became a drifter and headed west. First he kidnapped an auto mechanic, and then he killed the Mossers, and then he killed again a salesman from Seattle, and then kidnapped again before he was made in Mexico and turned over to the FBI. When he was arrested, he said, "I hate everybody's guts, and everybody hates mine." At just 23, he got the gas chamber at San Quentin. Jimbo told Jim the story of Billy Cook in his brief yet savage killing spree one night on Venice Beach, early on when the Doors first began. Jimbo was obsessed with this sort of lore, and for Jim, he found the slice of macabre Americana both appalling and fascinating. It resonated in similar stories of Bonnie and Clyde, the murder of the Clutter family in Holcomb, Kansas. The forces that rarely see the light of day, the darkness here in the light, the other side breaking on through. Jimbo's story kicked around in Jim's head for years. It was there when he made Highway in an American Pastoral, his experimental short film about a murderous hitchhiker, played by Jim. In the script, Jim's character's name is simply Billy. And then the Manson family murders happened, and the Zodiac Killer. Jimbo's Billy Cook tale kicked around some more. Jim thought it odd that Jimbo had spent so much time with the wizard himself, and that Jimbo was so fascinated with the likes of Billy Cook. And here he was, hanging out and drinking beers with this generation's Billy Cook, Charles Manson himself. Jimbo didn't speak much about Charlie after the shit hit the fan, and he and his Spawn Ranch family were arrested. And then there were Jimbo's Zodiac stories, the ones that seemed oddly familiar to some of the news stories Jim had read about the unknown killer's victims. But Jimbo would always say he was just fucking with Jim. But how should Jim explain what he saw that night in Patricia's apartment during the hand-fasting marriage ceremony? He snapped into his own highway killer fantasy, his own private Zodiac moment. He was on a highway. He was the killer on the road. His brain was squirming like a toad. He wasn't sure that he could trust himself with what was real and what wasn't anymore. Wasn't sure what to believe, especially from a drunken, unreliable narrator like Jimbo. Not that Jim himself was any more reliable. He simply couldn't exorcise the Billy Cook trope from his brain. Bruce Botnick played him Stan Jones' Ghost Riders in the Sky one night at the studio. A Western chestnut recorded by everyone from Burl Ives to Gene Autry. And immediately his brain went to highway kidnapping and murder, like it was a Pavlovian response. If you want to save your soul from hell riding on our range, then cowboy change your ways today or with us you will ride. He dumped the Billy Cook mess from his brain once more into the lyrics of Riders on the Storm, the creepy epic that would close out side two of LA Woman. After New Orleans, Jim flew back out to Los Angeles at Bruce's request and met him at Poppy Studios, one of Motown's West Coast studios, where Bruce was putting the finishing touches on the LA Woman album. He needed Jim to lay down a few final vocal tracks, including a harmony vocal on Hyacinth House, and then some atmosphere for that ominous closing track. Jim had Bruce add the rain and thunder sound effects, which lend the song some of its dread, and then added in his final vocal takes on a Doors record, or any record for that matter. Bruce started the tape up. It was rolling now. Jim held his hands tight to the headphones, cradling his ears. The rain came in, a clap of thunder, and the band playing its slow burn down the horizon. On cue, Jim opened his mouth and leaned into the microphone and whispered underneath his existing lead vocal, his breath hot and his voice tattered. Riders on the Storm. The Count provided the smack. He had the good stuff, the stuff that made the rest of the world irrelevant, the stuff that made you forget about yesterday, stop worrying about tomorrow, and sink you deep into an impossibly warm now. Skag was everywhere. An increasing number of American GIs were returning from Vietnam with heroin addictions. It was on the streets, in veins, up noses. It took down Janis Joplin, and it would soon take down more. Pamela craved it, needed it, missed it when she didn't have it, went nuts when she couldn't get it. She had gone full-blown junkie since she had been in Paris, where she stayed while Jim and the Doors were finishing LA Woman. She had felt the sting of heroin back in the States, working handshake deals in otherwise upscale LA neighborhoods while Jim was none the wiser. He was always too stoned on his own trip to stop and pay attention to hers. In Paris, she had quicker, more reliable access to junk. The Count scored it for her. That's Count Jean de Breteuil, a French aristocrat who Pamela found herself wrapped up with every time she was back in Paris. She had originally met the Count in Morocco when she was buying inventory for a boutique shop that she opened in 1969 on La Cienega in LA and peddled exotic furs, tapestries, and chic clothing. Jim had paid for the shop with the royalties he made from the Strange Days album. He wanted to call it Fucking Great, but she opted for the more subdued Themis. The joke was that Themis was so exclusive that it was never actually open. Given that it was a pet project with no real pressure to have the regular sustaining cash flow of a regular retail store, Pamela could drop out and hit the City of Lights when she wanted to. It was there that she could dive headfirst into her own fantasy. She was still Jim's, but she was also temporarily not Jim's. So she felt free to be someone else. Someone who had a Parisian tryst with her socialite drug-dealing lover, who was also a count. But she was always inextricably tied to Jim. In Paris, she went by Pamela Morrison, and the friend she hung out with knew her as Jim's wife. Jim's wife waiting patiently for her husband to meet up with her in the City of Lights. She had another Paris fantasy, that she'd get Jim to follow her across the pond. She'd give up the junk, he'd stop drinking, he'd shave his beard, comb his hair, he'd lose his beer belly, all that bloated water weight gone. He'd dry out, they'd stroll the foreign city hand in hand, freely. He'd drop the rock star thing, put the doors behind him. She knew that's what he really wanted to do anyway. That he limped around with the band tied around his ankle like a ball and chain, and he'd focus on his poetry. It would be romantic, artistic. Jim would be like Rimbaud or Baudelaire, and Pamela would be his muse. Jim had devoured texts by Camus, Sartre, and Wilde, and in Paris he could walk in the same steps as his literary idols. They'd marry for real. He'd cast off that fake marriage to Patricia, and they would settle into a life of quiet anonymity, surrounded by people who didn't speak their language. It would be a true reinvention. They would lose themselves once and for all, just get lost, real lost. Just like she was lost in this heroin high at the moment. Lost in the Count's two eyes, one green and one yellow. Lost in his accent. The higher she got, the more she fell under the Count's spell. She would forget about how he'd fire off on an angry tangent and hurl sentence after sentence of incomprehensible French at her. She would tell him about Jim, and sometimes, as they laid in bed together, higher than the night before, he would ask her to talk about Jim some more. He wanted stories. He wanted to know about the doors. She would suspect that the only reason he came around was to get closer to Jim, that perhaps one day, he'd walk into the room at the Hotel George and the Count could supply his dope straight to the source, straight to the rock star, and not just the rock star's girl. The Count wanted to be a rock star, but he had to settle for the European drug dealer to the rock stars. He split his time between Paris and London, where he circled an ominous orbit around the likes of Keith Richards and Anita Pallenberg. He provided the drugs, and the drugs paid for his entry into the lifestyles of the rich rock and rollers. Pamela said she was thinking of asking Jim again to come visit, to stay with her in Paris indefinitely. Back in Hollywood, Bruce and the gang were still mixing LA Woman. Jim didn't think it was quite ready yet. There were still some tweaks that needed to be made to the mix. They all agreed, but he had more pressing matters on his brain. He was still a free man in Los Angeles, albeit a free man on a $50,000 bond while his attorney, Max Fink, worked on his appeal. Things weren't looking good. He'd be doing time for sure, hard labor. Even worse, he'd be back in Florida, the land of his childhood that he'd worked so hard to repress, to leave behind, literally and figuratively. And the less time he spent back in that shithole, the better. It transcended Florida. And now, it was time to transcend the whole damn country. The rest of the doors were a little surprised when they heard that Jim had skipped town. But the more they thought about it, it was another one of Jim's impulsive decisions, and he was gone. Gone to find a lucky little lady in the City of Light, just another lost angel. On March 11, 1971, Jim Morrison stepped on a plane bound for Paris. For how long, he couldn't say. Long enough to get his head right, reassess, and then take it from there. He wouldn't last through the summer. He never came back. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. All right, The 27 Club is scored and co-written by myself, Jake Brennan. Zeth Lundy is the lead writer and editor on the show. Matt Bowden mixes the show. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. The 27 Club is released weekly every Thursday. Season 1 features 12 episodes on Jimi Hendrix, which are all available for you to binge right now, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe to the 27 Club on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your shows. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media. And we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. And you're going to want to give that a follow. So get out there and spread the word about 27 Club. And as always, you can find me blabbing about other crazy rock stars on my other shows, Disgraceland and Blood on the Tracks. And you can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter at DisgracelandPod. Rock and roll up.